morning, good morning, and welcome to episode 48 of Coffee with the Coder. We've had a wonderful bunch of episodes with everyone here and excited to share this one with you. Good morning, Paula.
Good morning.
And hopefully my phone will keep up with us today. I am going to start in, I love technology. I am going to start in on the questions that we have today and take notes about who's asking because I'm excited to give away a mug today, our weekly, every other week mugging, which means we're going to send an official AQIQ Coffee with the Coder coffee mug or tea mug, whatever you would like to use in it is fine, to someone who's asked a non-anonymous question today. And the first person who gets considered is Deborah in Florida. So, hi, Deborah. I'm excited that you're on the call. I don't know if you're on the call, but I'm excited that you sent this question. Let me read it out for Paula. Deborah said she's trying to find out information on how to bill for slow modes. The question is whether or not it would be billed with a malignant excision code based on the final excision. The code book doesn't specify slow modes staged procedures that occur on different days. It just states in the malignant excision guidelines that if it is determined based on path findings that the patient has to return for further excision of the lesion, that the final excision is coded. Would that apply to slow mos? The guidelines make it sound like it applies to an unplanned return for excision, but I think it would also apply to slow mos. Our dermatologist sends the specimen to pathology rather than reading it himself. If the margins aren't clear, the patient returns for further excision. My office has just been charging for the repair, and I think we should be charging for the excision. So thank you for your help.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Deborah, for that question. Well, one of the key things that stood out to us in the question is you said that your dermatologist sends the specimen out to pathology rather than reading himself. So Mohs is only billed, those CPT codes, and we're talking about CPT in the physician coding world is the question for those of you who are not in that world who call in. So Mohs is only billed when the physician works as the surgeon and the pathologist. So the scenario that you're describing would be billed as an excision in each visit with modifier 58 for the second and the subsequent visits unless the type of repair bundles that excision. So the very first visit the patient comes in, you're going to bill for the excision of the lesion, and if there's any repair that's done, which likely the repair is not done in that setting because they want to make sure they've got the margins clear, then you could report the repair also. However, most likely, like I said, you're going to come back for a second visit, which sounds like what you're stating in your question. The patient will come back, and then they will go back and excise more, and then possibly even a third. That second and third visit, if it is not on the same day as the initial excision, are billed with excision codes plus the repair. However, remember, when we're reporting in CPT, there are some specific rules. If a simple repair is performed, then you're only going to bill the excision. You're not going to bill the repair and the excision. However, for if the repair is adjacent tissue transfer, such as a Z-plasty or a VY-plasty, then you only bill the repair, not the excision. However, if you're reporting any other closure method, the intermediate, the complex, the graft, you're going to report both the excision of the lesion and the repair method. But in this case, we want to make sure that you report the most extensive or the CPT code with the highest RVU, that's the relative value unit, first. And sometimes your pricing isn't always the same, but you want to report that first because the second and third and so on procedures are usually cut in or reduced in price. So it's just a little multifactorial here, so you're either going to report the excision and then subsequent excisions on subsequent days with 58 modifier and then the repair based on the repair method, and then if it is simple, you're not reporting the repair, you're reporting just the excision, And if it's a adjacent tissue transfer, you're reporting the repair only, not the excision, and anything else, you're reporting both the repair and the excision on the date it's done.
Thank
Hope that
you.
Was clear.
Okay. And so I gather from that this is a physician office procedure?
Yes, that was a physician office procedure. Yes. It could happen
okay.
in a facility as well. It could happen in a facility
okay.
well, but it's physician billing and coding.
Okay, wonderful. Well, now I'm going to move over to an inpatient rehab. And Ramona has a patient with a left greater trochanteric avulsion fracture, which is non-surgical, one right rib fracture, and an L2 compression fracture. Would this be considered major multiple fractures? The rest of that is you.
She was asking that question because sometimes, you know, we have, in order to meet 60% major multiple, it should be two weight-bearing bones. So like upper and lower extremity, lower with ribs and sternum, are the ones that are qualifiers. So basically, you really have to look at the focus of care of that patient. Is the primary focus of care that hip, or is the primary focus of care the hip and the ribs and spine fractures? You know, is it equally weighted? And if so, then you could report the multiple fractures, the 8.4 IGC, but again, it would not meet 60% because it's not those qualifying fractures. However, you may want to consider if the hip is the primary and the spine and the ribs are secondary, meaning they're not a primary focus of care, they're just there, but they're comorbidities of the primary focus of treatment, then you're going to put that patient in a hip fracture IGC. So you really look at the documentation that the physician is providing related to that. And, you know, we actually, I wanted to talk about a couple of things other than a couple questions today because there were some things that came up in this week. And so I just kind of, we had those two questions, but I also want to talk about another question that we get and we have recently gotten from several people, and it's in the IRF setting. And I wanted to just discuss that rather than throw the question out from because we had so many people asking it, is that you know, if you have a patient in an IRF setting and they come in and they have maybe a traumatic fall and they have a subdural hemorrhage, and then at the same time they also have a stroke or some type of brain hemorrhage, and then they also have a stroke, but it's undetermined whether the stroke happened and the patient fell, or the patient fell and then they had a hemorrhage and a separate stroke. And it's undetermined if the residuals, which one they're due to. If the physician can clearly define, you know, what caused what and what the primary focus of care is, of course you're going to report that as your impairment group. But, and there is not a, I guess, a documented rule saying if two conditions equally meet. But in the coding world, there is a rule that says if two conditions equally meet the definition of principal diagnosis, you can select either. So in my head, it is all absolutely defensible. In talking with a physician who had this as his specialty, he's in rehab and he does everything related to the brain and strokes, and he said, you know, sometimes it's absolutely, well, many times, it's absolutely impossible to know, you know, which one came first and which one may have caused the other, you know, so it really is about, you know, they equally hold the weight. So in that case, it is very defensible for you to select either the traumatic brain injury or the stroke. Again, equal weight here, and it's undetermined which one is the primary focus of care. So most of the time, the TBI is higher valued, but it could work the other way based on the patient's FIM, so that needs to be considered as well. So you don't just automatically always select TBI because, you know, based on the FIMs, it could mean the stroke is a higher value in that case. So at any rate, if both happen and at around the same time and they're bringing the patient into rehab, you want to evaluate first, can I determine what the underlying reason is? And if they both have equal weight, I would say it's defensible to choose either. So, Pam, I just wanted to address that because we did have that question multiple times, from some folks, and I didn't think it was really fair to throw it out there and only give one person credit for asking.
Thank you. That was important. Although we want to get as many questions as we can, and it's not always that everyone asks the same question. It just happened this week because I guess when you're paying attention to a particular area, everything certainly fits in that area, right?
Exactly.
So awesome. Now, did you want to say something about the E&Ms, or did you want to save that for later?
Actually, I do want to go ahead and address it just because we've been doing, and we do audits for hospitals, physicians, inpatient rehab facilities, so we're in multiple areas. And there was one thing that came up in a recent audit that I feel like it's important to mention to this group. So if you're coding for a physician and you are looking at the evaluation and management codes and you are reviewing those services and you notice that there is a consistent, which usually it is, consistent between medical decision making and the history portion, there's a consistent deficit in, achieving the level that is most appropriate because the documentation of the elements are not there. One of the things we want to recommend that you do is go back and look at the physician's templates in the electronic medical record. Very often, and I've seen it multiple times, but it just hit me again last week, is multiple times we've audited these E&M records and noticed that maybe the physician in the exam, for instance, only spoke to, one body part in the musculoskeletal section. And it was consistent on every single visit. And with that said, we went back and looked at the template, and the physician didn't even have the opportunity to review any other body part because that was the only thing listed in the EMR. So I would say to you, when you start down the road and of doing E&M audits and educating your providers on how to document appropriately, validate those EMRs to make sure that all the options are available. Because that was a very big point. Again, I saw it again this week and wanted to make sure that I mentioned it to you guys in this group because I know I have some auditors on the line as well. So there you go, Pam.
Thank you. Okay, so drum roll, please. About to give away a cup. So this week's mugging winner is Deborah in Florida. Deborah, I am so excited about you. I don't know if you're the same Deborah that won one before, but that's quite all right. I'm going to reach out to you and find out where to mail this. Thank you, everyone. We so look forward to getting some more questions from you because we just love doing this. And so eventually we may end up doing it every week. But for right now, it's every other week. So the next episode, 49, will be on October 22nd at 10:10 Eastern. And do sign up for reminders if that's something that would be helpful for you. And we just look forward to seeing you on our webinar that's coming up on Thursday and any other training that we might be able to do together. You'll have a wonderful day.